The other day, I played an old-school-looking computer game that brought me back to my childhood. It's called The Silver Gymnasium, which is also the name of the new album released this week by the band Aukerville River. Frontman Will Sheff composed music for the game as well as the album and played a big role in the game's design. It follows a kid around Sheff's hometown in New Hampshire as he searches for his lost sister. And it's an interesting marketing tool in 2013, built in part by a guy who remembers his family's first computer.
We had an Apple IIc. Before that, video games, and I guess this is kind of that feeling of wonder was what I was trying to channel when I made the Silver Gymnasium video game. Video games were kind of the special thing you would go somewhere else to do. I remember that I grew up on the grounds of a school, a private school. My parents were teachers there. I grew up in the dorm.
Okay.
And there was a computer room, and they had a whole bank of IBMs. And you could go up there and type some kind of command in there, and there was some game that came preloaded on there. I don't remember very much about it. It was like a role-playing kind of sword and sorcery, go around and find things game, which is actually appropriate because that's, in a sense, some of the Silver Gymnasium draws on that. I also remember I used to go over to a friend's house and play Leisure Suit Larry. It was a friend whose teacher also taught at the school, or whose mother also taught at the school. And that was funny because you'd sneak down in the basement when they weren't around, and you'd – Leisure Suit Larry was supposed to be the dirty
Yeah. Game. I remember this. It was like – it was the game that like you kind of played secretively. Like
yes.
You didn't really – your parents – you didn't want your parents knowing you were playing Leisure Suit Larry because
yes.
There was something sleazy about
it. It was
him.
Sleazy. Yeah. Although the truth of Leisure Suit Larry is it was incredibly tame.
Yeah.
But it was really verboten, you know, for kids. So, like, and they would ask you these questions to ascertain whether you were an adult or not. And it would be like, who's the fourth Beatle? You know, Ringo, Steve, Rick. And it was this stuff where it's like, if you're a kid, like, let alone a kid who's like a music fan or even vaguely aware of culture at large, you know, it was really, really
so
easy. And then there was one about the Pope's name, and I was raised Catholic. And I was like, come on, man. Like, I had all of those questions. And he had a black and white monitor, so I would play Leisure Suit Larry on his black and white monitor. I grew up playing Atari, but I didn't – again, my parents, we didn't have a video game system, so that was something I played over at friends' houses.
Were you that kid who, like – I didn't have television when I was growing up. Were you that kid who, like, went to your friend's house and they were like, hey, let's play outside, and you were like, actually, we have to play video games
yes,
right now.
Yes, I was that kid, and my perspective of it was I was the kid who was desperate for this stuff, and I would go over to somebody else's house and go, can we play your Atari? Can we play it? And they would go, no, that's boring. That's, you know, like they would never want to, you know, or I would play, you know, they'd have cable or whatever. Anyway, so those were some of my first experiences. We actually got – I remember the first job I ever had, I was washing dishes for a summer, and with my first paycheck, I bought myself a Nintendo.
Nice.
And so that shows how important it was to me. But we had an Apple IIc, and we had the Oregon Trail, and Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, and the
– Classics, both
yeah.
Classics.
The games that your parents would be okay with you having.
Yeah.
And then there would always be – you know, the few little extra titles. My father must have heard something good about Maniac Mansion, or maybe he just went to the store and there was a display or something. But we had Maniac Mansion.
Shades of that are in this game?
Yes, yeah. For sure. Maniac yeah. Mansion was hugely influential on me as a kid, and not just on this game, but the whole feel of Maniac Mansion was a really was a really big influential thing for me. And the Sierra games too, King's Quest and Space Quest, which Leisure Suit Larry was their sort of After Dark title.
Right.
So, yeah, I really treasured those games. We also had, like, California Games, which was really fun but ultimately kind of super lame sports game. Which
was that the one
really
with Hacky Sack? Was
Hacky Sack was
and Frisbee, but you couldn't, like, the Frisbee game was so terrible.
Oh, the Frisbee game. That brings back sense memories. And we have, when I've been talking to Miles, the video game designer,
uh-huh.
there's certain things where, like, I still remember what it would sound like if the Frisbee fell, and it would be this kind of like, this kind of like really lame disappointment, the sound of disappointment and crappiness. And
Which chiptunes are very good at that.
Yeah.
8-bit, the sound of disappointment and crappiness, I feel like in that, you know.
When characters would die, it would always be like a humiliating death. There would always be a really herky-jerky animation where they would fall head over heels and like a crazy little sound would play, and it was like really embarrassing. But the funny thing about those games, though, is because you're a kid, you're investing a tremendous amount of your own emotional juju into those games.
Mm.
So even though they have these silly little 8-bit sounds and they have these really simple color schemes and everything, you're bringing this tremendous amount of your own interior landscape to them.
Mm-hmm.
And forever and ever, I wanted to do a game that kind of mimicked that effect, you know, that called up those sense memories. And the most flattering thing that anybody's been saying to me about this Silver Gymnasium game is they'll say, you know, it definitely takes me back. It definitely gives me those memories. So I wanted to call those up, but I also wanted to call up the charge that came with that, the feeling that there was a hidden sort of secret aspect to the games.
It's very good at that. And let's just take a minute and play the game for a second, or let me play and you sort of direct
okay.
me where to go. Is that cool?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to pull this around, actually.
Okay.
So that we can both see
it. All right, there we go.
And I, by the way, just FYI, I've played through the first chapter, I think.
Yes.
I got to the doors in the mausoleum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as far as I've gotten so far.
Yeah.
But we'll pretend that, you know, we're starting from zero.
Oh,
here,
okay.
So.
Okay.
Okay. Pretty simple controls here. Walk.
Yeah.
With
so
the
you
arrow
could
keys.
Hear, there's actually very subtle sound going on right at the beginning. Were you going to put the sound on, or?
I actually think in this setup I can't, but we'll add it after
okay.
if that's okay. Yeah.
So it starts with this sort of chiptunes version of It Was My Season. And then really quickly you get these kind of cutscene screens of the protagonist, who, by the way, is not necessarily supposed to be me.
Right.
I changed his appearance slightly early on.
Okay.
In the process to sort of make that a little more clear.
Is darker.
Yeah, I didn't go crazy trying to make it not look like me because I like that kind of gray area. But he's sort of just intended to be a kid with glasses. Maybe sort of shades of me, but not really supposed to be me.
I like that the first thing he says is, I should get off the computer and go outside.
We talked a lot
about...
As we begin the game where we're going to be sitting in our chairs playing it.
Okay, so you've got like a bedroom here. There's some posters on the wall.
Yep.
And I liked actually this thing a lot when I played it a little bit earlier. But like... I can sort of interact with things in the room by, I think, space bar. Is that right? Or something like that?
Yeah, I guess so. I actually usually just walk up to them. But in this room, you'll hear there's this – I actually put a lot of work into the soundscape here, though it's quiet. There's a – it's a room tone, and it's the room tone sound of my keyboard player Justin's room.
I was going to ask, yeah.
And there's some blackbirds singing in the background. And then off to the right, you can hear somebody closing a hatchback of a car. So, like, we really got into it. Yeah, we tried a lot to put in the sense of these worlds being real. So a lot of the time, you're looking at this very obviously fake interior room, in this case, this kid's bedroom. But you're hearing a pretty realistic soundscape, and it's also very stereo. So there's kind of things are placed in different parts of the stereo field.
This happened to me the other day. I was playing the game, and I went away from it. And I was, it was one of those days where I had like 30 tabs open in my browser, and I was in the basement of the library.
Yeah,
and I was like, "What the heck is like?" I like my speakers kept making this weird sound. I was like, "What the heck is going?" And I had to go through, and I was like, "Oh, it's because I'm in the middle of this game."
Well, in the library, there's this ticking grandfather clock sound. That's upstairs. And then there's the sound of two different libraries that are kind of mixed together. But when you go downstairs into the basement, there's a very heavy reverb on all the exact same loop that you hear above. So there's this sort of cavernous basement-y sound there. And it's actually, we were like, this will be pretty cool. But when we actually heard it, it's a pretty neat subterranean effect.
Totally. And it's amazing. You've obviously nerded out really hard on the sound design of this game.
I think that anything worth doing is worth nerding out really hard over. You know, this is a more nerdy enterprise than some, but this is the same amount of detail that's fun to bring to anything. And I do feel that even if people don't know that I put that much work in, they'll feel it in some way. They'll feel that there was like love that was put into it.
I feel like that's the same is true of music.
I agree.
They may not recognize it immediately, but they feel it somehow, which is,
yes.
It's like, I feel like live, that's true. Like if you're having a bad time,
yeah,
people may not like realize you're having a bad time,
but they can feel the sort of air bubbles from it. There's on Lido Pier's Suicide Car, there's this glass harmonica. We spent all this time getting special crystal wine glasses and filling them certain amounts of water and tuning them with like an eardropper. And we had one of the interns helping us play the glass harmonica. And if you really listen to it, you might just think it's a synthesizer. Probably most people do. But I like to think that the fact that it's not, that what you're hearing is crystal resonating with water in it, you know, is adds a little bit of, you know, a little bit of love and care and stuff into things.
Cool.
So here you're seeing the, you put your Walkman on.
Yeah, that was an important part that we, put the Walkman on. Okay, go ahead.
And there's this chiptunes version of Down Down the Deep River, which is the first piece of music I made for this. You pass by and you see this picture of the little kid and his sister. And his sister is actually a very important part of the game, because what he's doing is he's trying to find her.
This is his quest.
Yes. Yeah, it will become apparent. At this part, early on in the game, it's less apparent. But soon, because he goes into this kitchen, there's a note that his parents have left for him. And the note says, it's from his mom and dad. They say, you know, we've gone to visit your grandmother. Your sister's in charge while we're gone, and we'll make you dinner.
Except now, she's gone.
But she's nowhere to be found. And he's hungry.
As all little boys are all the time.
As all little boys are always. And if you actually go back down, you know, you could try to go to the refrigerator and you wouldn't. You'd see that he can't. He says, I don't know how to cook. He's a really helpless little kid. Although he turns out to not be helpless as things go on. So what you want to do is walk out the door on the other side of the room.
This over here?
Go back up there. Sorry. So go down.
Oh, this out here. Oh,
no,
yeah.
No. Up,
oh, sorry.
Again. Sorry. It's, the door's off screen a little. So go down, then go to the right.
Oh, yeah.
And you see these big doors.
I remember this now, yeah.
And here we go out into the town. It's a sunset. So it is getting on dinner time. And at this point, and we talked about this. I talked about this with Miles a lot. We kind of give people
nudges.
Yeah. Well, we give them a choice of which direction to go. And I think the choice is to a certain extent determined by the fact that most people read left to right in the United States and are right-handed. So I think that they tend to go right. It turns out that right is not the correct way to go.
That's exactly what happened to me. I went as far as I could go to the right and then discovered I had to go left.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, that was – and doing little things like that, that was really fascinating, because you're trying to tell a story, but you're not – telling the story, you're planting the story and hoping that people come across the story in the order that you want them to. And that's a really interesting part about video game storytelling that I couldn't – well, I guess I could have anticipated it, but it turned out to be very essential to the whole idea. Is you're creating this world, and really, really creating a world. And people talk about songwriting as creating a world, or making a record as creating a world, or writing a novel, but – you're literally kind of, or as close to literally as you can get without being, I don't know, an architect or something. You're literally creating a world in a video game. And it's a fake imaginary world, but people have a sense memory, even in this sort of very obviously fake scenario that we've created. The first time I played it, I went to bed and I woke up and I felt like I'd been in the world in my dreams. It kind of already started to seep in a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So that's something we really tried hard to do. So we'll just cut to the chase and you can go left.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, is there a part in this first chapter here that is referenced on the album? Is there anything that sort of appears in both?
There's a little bit of that throughout, although with this particular so then there's this fellow here who's standing in the street who can't wait until they build a mall in town.
Screw that guy.
I always thought about, you know, there's that Laurie Anderson song. I think it's actually the title track on Big Science where it's like, turn left at that new shopping mall that they're going to put in. And that's what I think about with that. This building in the background, that blue building, is based on a machine shop.
Oh, machine shop.
That's in the town next to mine called Dingy Machine. In fact, almost all of the buildings that you'll see in this game are based on real places in my town. This is based on a combination of the Meriden Deli Mart and the another gas station place in Cornish. So you can go in here to this little deli mart, and this is kind of based on my memory of the little deli mart that sold videos, that rented videos,
and also other food items, and
So a lot, all these actually. If you look up and down, like Cannibal Holocaust, I remember was the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, Creepers, which is a Dario Argento film that Jennifer Connelly was in. They're all there. And then this Scott Coffey Space Camp starring Scott Coffey is me sort of very teasingly shouting out my very good friend Scott Coffey, who's an actor who was in that film.
Did he go to space camp?
Oh, no.
He's in space camp. And, oh,
he's in
wow.
space camp.
Okay, cool.
So this this is very much just a sort of a world-building level, this store. There's not that much in this store that actually ties in with the plot.
Right.
But we talked a lot, Miles and I, about giving people a whole lot of stuff to do and a whole lot of ways to interact. So if you go back to that store owner, he says different things every time. In fact, several of the characters say different things every time. And that stuff will be called back to.
Interesting. So we'll take some of that and sort of weave it into to the queue. So tell me a little bit about you know, obviously the record and the game harken back to your childhood. Why do you think this is sort of such rich subject matter for you and for others? I mean, you're not the only person who's done this, obviously. So
I think the reason that it's rich subject matter for me is the same reason that it's rich subject matter for others, and that's the reason that I wanted to do it. I found myself obsessing about my childhood, almost morbidly obsessing about my childhood. And I found myself wanting to sort of prop up and give props to people that I'd grown up with and the places that I'd grown up with. And I've always had a really fond sort of soft place in my heart for my home state. And I wanted to, especially because nobody thinks about it ever. Nobody thinks about New Hampshire ever. So for that reason, I kind of wanted to.
They're like, it's next to Vermont, maybe.
Something about Vermont. And that's the worst because it's so different from Vermont.
Yeah.
But for that reason, you know, I guess was part of it. But I also started feeling like the only cure for this crazy, mournful, morbid nostalgia that I was feeling was to really fully exercise it by making a work about it. And making a work about it was something I really kind of always wanted to do. I was always into sort of those memoirs of childhood, and I was always into, I always have had a lot of opinions about how to make art about the lives of children and a lot of opinions about what not to do. But at the same time, I really wanted to make something that people of my generation could enjoy, you know, could really relate to, and that would connect with them on a deep level, a much deeper level than do you remember this artifact of the 80s or do you remember that artifact of the 80s?
Sure.
I wanted to make something that plugged into to other people's nostalgia and that was comforting to people who were going through the same thing that I was, which is a sort of a sense of loss. Really, the record is very happy sounding and upbeat. And to a certain extent, it's about my childhood and about nostalgia. But to another extent, it's about losing that. And it's about coming to terms with lost time, kind of. And that's a sort of a symptom that I feel like a lot of people are probably suffering from, and that I wanted to create something useful for. The last record that we did was very screamy and angry and vicious and prickly and kind of pushed people away. That was a particular phase I was feeling in that time in my life. For this record, for whatever reason, maybe because in the same way that I'm trying to do now, I got that out of my system.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a record that wasn't screamy and assaultive and mean and that doesn't feel like a slap in the face, but that feels like a pat on the back, you know, a friendly record that's warm and giving towards the listener.
It sounds like you accept and embrace whatever you're feeling at the time as you're doing this, and that's seems like a much more effective way of making music than trying to maintain some sort of consistency of like voice or sound. Or
when you look at our records, you'll notice that they skip all over the place tonally, and that's something that I really enjoy. I like that Black Sheep Boy is the dark, tormented record. I like that Stage Names is the boozy, extroverted record. You know, I like these things, and I don't try to swear allegiance to any one of those tones. I just kind of really like going on. Mm. What I think the most important thing is to follow a direction that you truly, truly have some passion invested into. And so I don't really care too much about, or at least I try not to care too much about, what other people think that we should do or what other people think that they want. I think if I was chasing after that, the people who think that they know what it should be would regret it. You know, I think that my task as an artist is to follow the thing that's really getting me excited and the sort of nagging, tugging feeling that I get inside myself.
Sure.
And I just try to give myself over to those things fully. And usually by the end of the cycle, for that reason, I'm ready to do something totally different. Because after, all this time with Black Sheep Boy being sad and vulnerable, I wanted to be, you know, drunk and happy. And after 3 years of being drunk and happy, I wanted to not be friendly and happy anymore and to kind of like shake off some of the things that I didn't like about the last record. You know, there was like every record on some level is a reaction to the past one, but they're also kind of a reaction to where I am in my life. And I like that. I've built up this sort of symbiotic relationship with a fan base over time, and I like to feel like we influence each other. I like to feel like I try to give them something that will be of some sort of use to them.
Hmm. Do you think in 2013 artists have to give more than just an album when they have a release?
Well, yes. I think that they have to is a sort of a strange way of putting it. But I do think that the actual record itself is worth so little now. I mean, when you think about how it's available for free on torrent sites and how it's available for on Spotify and, you know, the artist gets like a couple cents for that. The actual record that you poured all your blood, sweat, and tears into and you lavished with all your love is the thing that's worth the least. And these strange little promotional things end up being important. And it's a really tough situation for people who don't have a knack for doing that kind of stuff. For me, in this particular case, I really enjoyed that opportunity because I like working. I want to work in as many different art forms as I can before I die. You know, I like working in film. I like writing. I like making a video game. It's really a fun challenge for me. It's a really fun growth opportunity for me. I mean, art is just the best thing there is for me, and I just really always want to be working. So it's a great way to, you know, to have an excuse to do this stuff. But I do think that it's a kind of an odd situation where the money for music is rapidly drying up and nobody really knows where it's going to come from. And there's also kind of a lot of people out there who are just sort of like, well, tough, you know, like you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. There's a lot of sort of even new media champions who are like, well, this is the way it is and people need to adapt and get used to the new way. And it's sort of like, to me, the shame of it is not so much in the fact that the money's drying up. The shame of it is I think that people don't have quite the same opportunity to enjoy albums the way that they did. I think that Spotify and the stream of music coming out of your little tinny computer speakers interrupted by advertising and playlists that you can skip through because you got impatient and your thumb got itchy, I think that that is a really cheap, puny experience compared to – sorry, my phone went off. I think it's
somehow that was appropriate in a way.
I know. I think it's a really cheap, puny experience compared to the ritualistic aspects of listening to music. Now, I do love listening to vinyl, for example. I'm not like a sort of old man vinyl purist, but the thing I like about listening to vinyl is the same thing I like about, you know, making my coffee in the morning. It's sort of like the ritual of it is telling yourself, this is special. This is meaningful to me.
This is what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. And you know, if you've ever put on a record because or an iTunes playlist or whatever because you're you need it. You really need music to cheer you up at that moment. You're feeling down, you know, for whatever reason. You're going out to a party. You need to get excited. You're feeling a little tired. You're mad at someone and you want to get your anger out by playing, you know, the Slayer record or whatever. If you've ever done that, you know what it's like to use music ritualistically and medicinally.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a tremendous power to that, and it just keeps getting smaller and smaller. You know, back in the day, using music ritualistically meant maybe somebody's going to, you know, play a song that's actually going to heal you. Or maybe somebody's going to play at your wedding, like a band's going to play at your wedding. And in that moment where they're playing the song that they always play at the wedding, it's like a celebration of all the generations of your family. And it's like a blessing for, you know, all the future generations. And that's what music used to mean. And now it's just some like tiny little terrible tinny sounding stream coming out of your MacBook speakers off Spotify. I think that's kind of a shame. So that's the part that I feel sadder about. It's not the fact that the money's drying up. And as far as new media and making movies and putting them out on the web and making video games and putting them up online, I mean, that's fun because it is creative. So I kind of do embrace that. I guess I can kind of see both sides of it in a way.
You may have just sort of answered my next question, which was going to be to you, what is the best thing technology has done for your music, and what is the worst thing it's done to music? And you may have just answered the second part of that, but
go ahead. I think of the second part of it. The second part of that question is kind of what I said. I think it's made music more trivial, and I think that the internet and gadgets and stuff in general have made people more impatient about everything. For example, I think probably every single one of your listeners can relate to the experience of like watching some video online, and even though you really like it, you don't watch the ending of it. It's like, wow, this is incredible. This is amazing. And then you just get up and walk away from it, or your fingers automatically type in your favorite time-wasting website and hit return instead.
Yeah.
Even though you're fully aware that what you're watching is totally great. I think that that's a real it's really robbed something from people's aesthetic sort of appreciation of stuff and their situation in the world aesthetically.
What about the best thing?
The best thing it's done for me is it's great how portable music has become. I'm about to go on tour for the rest of the year, and when I was making the Love Streams record, which is a record that I did that's pretty much all electronic, and I released a couple songs from it, and most of it was done for my own happiness, and it was something I kind of needed to do personally. I made that on the bench in the van driving down the interstate, and I can do that again. I can, like, record my podcasts out of the van. I can do more music for the Silver Gymnasium game, do more of this 8-bit chiptune stuff, you know, sitting in a hotel room in my underwear at like 3 a.m. if I feel like it. And not only that, but once I'm done, I can email it to Benjamin Miles in Chicago and he'll pop it right into the game. And then he can write me back and say, I think you should turn up this, you know, little drum hit here, and I can do it. And the fact that I can do all that stuff from anywhere, from a hotel, from a van, from my bed, you know, like walking down the street even, that stuff is really fun and exciting to me. So I'd say that the way that it's enabled me personally, that I can only speak about me, the way that it's enabled me to make art anywhere is fun.
Will Sheff of Aukerville River has a new album out. It's called The Silver Gymnasium, and it goes with a computer game. Will, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.